This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening, it's the evening edition. You're with Caroline and Ezra. Now, according to UNICEF Malaysia, there are 445,006 people with disabilities registered in Malaysia as of 2012. However, as registration is voluntary, it is not reflective of the real numbers in the country.
Yeah, and although Malaysia has taken important steps to protect the rights of people with disabilities by ratifying the Convention of the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, that's the CRPD, first in many acronyms to come this evening.
Absolutely, absolutely.
This was in 2010 and adopted the Person with Disabilities Act 2008, which provides social protection services in areas such as health, rehabilitation and education for children with disabilities. There's still a social stigma attached, isn't there?
There is. And of course, it's attached to primarily to persons with disability and given equal opportunities, namely in education and employment. Here in the studio to explore the matter further are Dr. Derek L. Cogburn, Executive Director of Institute on Disability and Public Policy, that's IDPP, as well as Dr. Islin Ismail, Deputy Director, International Institute of Public Policy and Management in Puma at University of Malaya. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
To kick things off, Dr. Cogburn, tell us about yourself and IDPP. When and why was it established?
Sure. So IDPP was established coming out of a long discussion with the Executive Director of the Nippon Foundation, Mr. Suichi Ono, and the chairman of the Nippon Foundation, Mr. Yohai Sasakawa. The Nippon Foundation is one of the largest private foundations in Japan, and they have a long history of working to alleviate poverty and to work on issues to better society around the world. And they have a strategic partnership with ASEAN. And they wanted to identify a way to build human capacity with persons with disabilities and for persons with disabilities in the ASEAN region to be able to handle the public policy issues, both the formulation of public policies, the development, and the monitoring of public policies in this area. So the IDPP was designed as a virtual networked organization to work with universities around the region and with partnerships around the world to focus on building human capacity at the master's level for persons with disabilities in ASEAN and people who are blind or visually impaired, deaf or hard of hearing, or mobility impaired. So we were launched in April 2011 formally with four partners, and now we've grown to 20 university partners in ASEAN.
I mean, clearly it's something that requires a lot of attention, but when it was first initiated, what was it in response to?
So it was in response to this growing recognition of the complexity of the public policy issues designed to help facilitate persons with disabilities and the need for persons with disabilities to be able to be at the table and represent themselves.
Right.
So when the Millennium Development Goals were negotiated around the turn of the century, they were designed to alleviate poverty by the year 2015 and a whole range of other grand economic development goals. It completely ignored disability. So disability wasn't included. And so if you're trying to raise economic opportunities for women, for children, alleviate poverty, and not addressing persons with disabilities, it's unlikely that you'll reach those targets.
Right.
And so when the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities was developed, or the CRPD, it was designed to be a comprehensive treaty to be able to address those issues. And you couple that in the Asia-Pacific region with the Incheon strategy to make the right real for persons with disabilities in Asia and the Pacific. Because there are more than a billion people in the world with disabilities, and that's a conservative number. We think that the number is probably a lot higher, and
right.
that comes from the World Health Organization and the World Bank's report on global disability. But the UNSCAP has had three decades of experience working in this area, and they developed the Incheon strategy to focus on making that right real in the Asia-Pacific region. So the answer to your question is this complex policy environment requires persons with disabilities to be trained in public policy, to be able to understand that policy environment, to understand their own rights within that policy environment, but to be able to advocate for those rights and to be able to help monitor the national implementation of those policies in their countries and around the region and the world.
All right, we'll go into greater detail in just a little bit. In the meantime, Dr. Islin, if you could tell us a little bit about In Puma.
Right. Thank you so much, Caroline and Ezra, for having us here. Well, IMPUMA actually is the Institute of Public Policy and Management at University of Malaya. We were set up somewhere in the early 2000s, and our master's program began in 2005, our master's in public policy. At that point, we were the only university, we were the only public policy program at the postgraduate level in Malaysia. And I think even today, we're one of the not just the oldest, perhaps the only current one that focuses solely on public policy. Other universities probably has a dual focus with public admin or other other fields. So, taking that point of view, we have had, at least coming to 10 years training graduates who will go on to become policymakers in their own respective areas. And given that public policy is very multidimensional in approach, some of them go back and serve different ministries, either in Malaysia or internationally. We've had students coming from Africa, from West Asia, and and other countries within our region. We have never, as Derek mentioned, actually touched on the issue of disability policy. So this collaboration with the Institute on Disability and Public Policy, IDPP, is very exciting for us because it opens a different dimension. And it will also be good for our students to interact directly with people we would consider a little special, but I would like the whole interaction to be inclusive, within the same class without any extra special consideration, so that our student gets socialized into that whole environment. Sure. And also for the disabled students to interact with other students, because at the end of the day, the aim after getting education is for you to go on into the workforce or life and do that interaction going forward.
I mean, what I'm sensing is there is a lot of perhaps a lack of public awareness about some of the significance and importance of these issues. Why is that? Is it just not sexy enough in the public domain?
Well, I think there are multiple issues, right. But I think on the one hand, you have many people who have just never come into contact with persons with disabilities, and there's a lack of understanding, a lack of awareness, a lack of this question of how do they do what they do. Mm. So it's interesting. So if you go back to the CRPD, Article 8 of the CRPD focuses on awareness raising. So countries that are signatories and have ratified the convention are committing themselves to a series of activities to raise awareness in their countries around persons with disabilities, for that very reason, because there is a stigma. We don't have sufficient images of persons with disabilities, and so there's a need to address that. You find sometimes people will say, if a student is blind or visually impaired, how do they access their course material? And there are a whole range of ways that they can, and there are tremendous, there are examples of people who have been blind who are rocket scientists and who are doing all kinds of things around the world. But if you've never seen that, that lack of exposure leads to discrimination against a person like that.
We're speaking about the rights of persons with disabilities and its relation to public policy. Stay tuned to the Evening Edition on BFM 89.9. Good evening. It's the Evening Edition. You're with Caroline and Ezra. In the studio with us is Dr. Derek L. Cogburn, as well as Dr. Islin Ismail. Dr. Derek is from the IDPP, as well as Dr. Islin is from IMPUMA at University of Malaya. We're speaking about persons with disabilities and public policy and how it all relates to that. Dr. Derek, you were just mentioning a little bit off air about what it means exactly when a country signs on to the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, or CRPD, what that distinction is between signing and ratifying it.
Sure. So it's an important distinction. So A country has the right to, every country in the world that's a member of the United Nations has a right to sign onto the treaty. That's the first step. It's an indication of a commitment towards ratifying the treaty and implementing the treaty. The second step is ratification, when the treaty becomes binding on that state party, what's called the state party. Mm-hmm. And once the treaty becomes binding, the country then has a legal obligation to start to implement the parameters of the convention or of the treaty. A couple of other things kick in. Every year, there's a conference of state parties where every country in the world that has ratified the convention is able to come together, share best practices, sure. lessons learned, how much progress they've made on implementing the convention. And if a country hasn't ratified the convention, even if they've signed the convention, they don't have a seat in that process. And then secondly, there is a report that is required by the state party. So after the state signs, 2 years after, after the state ratifies, 2 years after that, they are required to submit a progress report, basically, on how much they've made progress on each of the 50 articles of the convention. There's one other piece. There's something called the optional protocol to the convention. This will get us pretty deep in the weeds, so I won't go too far into it. But the optional protocol assigns additional responsibilities to a global expert committee called the Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Mm-hmm. This is a globally elected expert body who basically serve as reviewers of country progress towards the convention. And so if you have signed the optional protocol, that committee actually has the right to hear complaints from citizens.
It really puts the country in a bit of a more of a spotlight.
Correct. Right. So if you look at the number of countries that have ratified the convention, it's about 158. Mm-hmm. The number of countries that have ratified the optional protocol is something like 70 or 80, so far fewer.
All right. So can you explain this gap, perhaps frame it for us, this gap between actually signing and ratifying? I mean, why is there this leeway?
Sure. Well, I'll start in if Dr. Isner wants to jump in. So countries tend to take two broadly different perspectives. Some countries will sign and ratify immediately, and then they will look at their own policy environment and see how closely the policy environment aligns with the requirements of the convention. Other countries take a more circuitous route. They will sign the convention. They'll then look at their own policy environment. They'll conduct studies to see how close all of their different legal environment and policy environment matches the responsibilities of the treaty. And then once they feel comfortable that it does, or they've enacted any national legislation that needs to be put in place, then they'll ratify so that they're in compliance when they ratify the convention. So it's a difference of perspective in the countries.
And Dr. Islin, what does that mean when Malaysia had ratified it in 2010? I mean, does that mean that, upon signing it, there was a show of good faith about this particular issue? And does it mean now that we're sort of willing to open up the doors, to the rest of the world, saying, look, this is how we do it in Malaysia?
Yes, I think, because if we were to ratify at the point of signing and then come back and find that we're not ready to report good stories, that wouldn't sound very nice at all. So I think the Malaysian approach of being a bit more conservative and look at our policies before ratifying is understandable. And right now, given that recently the National Education Blueprint has been launched, where inclusive education is a big part of it, and in fact, we were just made to know that a lot more schools, I think more than 1,000 schools, primary and secondary, around the country, has been equipped or being, upgraded to include disabled students into the normal curriculum and normal school environment. Of course, it's still a work in progress, but I think it just shows that we are moving in the right direction.
Because in the past, it used to be that persons, they would go to special schools, yes, and essentially be segregated from, yes, the regular curriculum.
Yes.
In that time, I mean, apart from the environment of education, has there been progress made in other areas as well?
Well, I would think overall there has been progress, and the convention actually represents a major fundamental global shift in how to look at persons with disabilities away from what historically has been called the medical model to what's called the social justice or the rights-based model. So the medical model really was dominated by the approach that there's something wrong with this person.
And it has to be treated.
Yeah. And I feel so sorry for you, and let's see if the medical community can fix you and bring you back up to quote-unquote normal. That was sort of the old model. The new model is there's nothing wrong with me. There's nothing wrong with a person with disability. There are social decisions that were made that provide an impediment to that person. So for example, if you build a building and you built the building with stairs only and you didn't build the building with a ramp, that was your decision that is now causing an impediment to the person who's mobility impaired. It's not them. If you had built the building with a ramp, they could get in, you know, just as easily.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. The disability community has different sectors and different communities. So the deaf and hard of hearing community, for example, many people in the deaf and hard of hearing community never like to be called hearing impaired, particularly people who were born deaf. They feel like they are completely fully functional.
Right.
They have a whole language. They have a way to communicate. So they don't see themselves as being hearing impaired at all. So there is that movement to this rights-based approach. So the CRPD is the first human rights treaty of the 21st century. And these reporting mechanisms that we were talking about are in the same international process as other human rights review processes. So the UN Office of the High Commission for Human Rights supports the Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disability, and that's the body that receives these reports that are coming in.
Right, so it sounds like a far more nuanced perspective, I suppose, is also what you want to get out. Is there a tangible sort of end game in all these steps that we're talking about?
Well, the end game is to create a level playing field so that persons with disabilities can achieve everything that they can contribute. They can contribute to the economy, they can contribute to society, they can contribute and enjoy the rights of recreation and employment and everything. So that's the end game, is to level the playing field and make sure that they can achieve their rights.
I would also think that there should be a shift from just looking at disability policy as a cost to society, and instead also embrace the benefit that we can get out of it by bringing in the disabled community into the productive sector so that they now become productive members of society. So the benefit is never highlighted before because we've only looked at the cost side.
But that's the thing. I think my view, or I guess a layman's view, is that Malaysia, by and large, still looks at it as a cost situation. And in the past, I don't know, 10, 20 years, I assume there's a lot of progress has been made, but it's not necessarily brought into the mainstream.
Right. That's correct. I frequently write and talk about a moral rationale, an economic rationale, and a legal rationale for moving in this direction. The moral rationale, it's the right thing to do. We want to make sure everybody's included. But if that doesn't motivate you, the economic rationale is multifaceted. One is if you have an accessible website, an accessible bank, an accessible app, an accessible organization, persons with disabilities will flock to your organization or your website. Mm-hmm. If you don't, they'll go someplace else. So you'll lose that economic benefit. Plus the fact that persons with disabilities can start new businesses. They can contribute tremendously within organizations. So absolutely, Dr. Islin, I think that focusing on that point is absolutely critical.
And also, I think, just to add on, we always get the impression, at least I think, me, and perhaps also in Malaysia, that a disabled person is disabled at birth. But a lot of disability occurs further down the line. You're not born disabled. You have been functioning normally, and suddenly something happens. Either an accident or an illness, and then you're turned disabled. So, you know,
how do you involve these folks into the entire configuration?
Yes.
We're speaking to Dr. Derek L. Cogburn, Executive Director of Institute on Disability and Public Policy, that's IDPP, as well as Dr. Islin Ismail, Deputy Director at the International Institute of Public Policy and Management in Puma at University of Malaya. We're speaking about persons with disabilities and public policy. We'll be right back after this on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. Good evening, I'm Ezra Zayed.
Good evening, I'm Caroline O.
And this evening we're speaking about the issue of persons with disabilities and public policy. With us is Dr. Derek Cogburn, Executive Director of Institute on Disability and Public Policy, that's IDPP, as well as Dr. Islin Ismail. She's from the International Institute of Public Policy and Management in Puma at University of Malaya. Now, the significance of this collaboration between both of these two organizations or institutions is that what's happening next year with Malaysia chairing ASEAN in January 2015 will be a real opportunity to, I guess, crystallize a lot of the initiatives that are taking place.
I think that's so. ASEAN has developed a number of strategic objectives, from strategic human resources directives, employment-oriented strategies, and also a Vision 2020, which talks about including as many ASEAN citizens as possible, bringing in marginalized and disenfranchised citizens. So there are a number of strategies within ASEAN as an organization that speak to the need for a focus on persons with disabilities, but there hasn't yet been a concrete adoption of a strategy within ASEAN to focus specifically on inclusive education and persons with disabilities in that way. And so if you look at the CRPD, Article 24 of the convention focuses on inclusive education and again commits states parties to creating inclusive educational practices. And given that all 10 countries in ASEAN have signed the CRPD, with only Brunei and Vietnam left to ratify, there is now the political infrastructure within the region to start focusing on each of those areas. And I think Article 24, inclusive education, is one of the ones that leads to our partnership.
And so what does that mean for inclusive education? What's promising in the near future? What can we look forward to, and what are some of the challenges and obstacles in place?
Well, inclusive education is the first principle in the National Education Blueprint. And inclusive education is much bigger than just looking at persons with disability. It includes all the marginalized parts of community. You know, for us, the orang asli, the poor, those who are living in non-urban areas. So it's a much wider scope there. And for us at education institutions, it will be a challenge, because for each different set of group of people that you would like to include into education, you have different considerations to make. So I think the collaboration that we have with IDPP, we've started collaborating 2 years ago, but it's this year that we've sort of like taken on a much bigger role in this whole agenda. And, you know, even for us, we feel, I wouldn't say hesitant, but it's a big challenge to take on.
Because there are so many aspects to it. I mean, yes. From infrastructure issues, yes, to getting the right personnel to be in the right environments. I mean, because there are so many stakeholders involved. I mean, is that part of the job description right now? I guess trying to sort of string together everybody's involvement?
It is, and we're very pleased to be collaborating with the University of Malaya on this project. The University of Malaya and Mpuma have been wonderful partners in this next and important phase of the IDPP evolution. When we founded IDPP, we at American University launched the world's first virtual master's degree on disability and public policy in the world. And we're very proud of that. It was the first completely online degree at American University. There have been several subsequent online degrees. And we thought that online cyber learning approach was very valuable, because a person with a disability or without a disability could participate from their home. They wouldn't have to leave their jobs. If they had jobs, they could be very comfortable in that environment. And we still think that has a lot of value. But we also wanted to explore residential-based programs, which the Mpuma Master of Public Policy is a residential-based program, a very rigorous, high-quality, high-profile master's program. And we wanted to be able to see if highly qualified students with disabilities from throughout the region could apply, get accepted, and do well in this kind of program. And so moving from an accessible cyber learning or online model to a residential model has presented some opportunities, but also some challenges. So some of the opportunities include the ability for the students to live together. So they're living together in the 7th Residential College at the University of Malaya, which is a very accessible environment for students who are blind and visually impaired or mobility impaired or deaf and hard of hearing. We can use that physical residential environment to build a learning community where mentors can come in and speak to the students, spend some time with them. We can provide targeted support in terms of, let's say, students who are deaf and hard of hearing who might want to have more sign language interpretation. Mm. So there's some real advantages to this face-to-face community and building networks and so forth. But there are certain challenges as well. Because in a completely online environment, we could have faculty members from anywhere in the world teaching in the program. We could have closed captioners for every session be anywhere in the world without having to find a closed captioner here in KL to get them to provide closed captioning in the room. Or sign language interpreters. We were able to contract with sign language interpreters all around who could come into the virtual environment and provide sign language interpretation from wherever they were. Now we have to do all that in a face-to-face environment and a physical environment. So it requires coordination, scheduling, you know, to make sure that we have all those resources to support the students.
Right. And with the students in the university, I suppose, just out of curiosity, how are other students responding? I suppose, you know, the idea is to sensitize or, you know, just get used to the idea of, you know, having everybody together. Are they responding well?
Well, University of Malaya as a campus has been receiving disabled students since the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. I didn't even realize it went back that far until I started this project.
Right.
So what I understood was that the university began taking in blind or visually impaired students much earlier, since the 70s. So in terms of the campus facilities and support services, it's pretty much much ahead in that sense.
But student interaction.
Yes. But most of the disabled students that have come to campus tend to be undergraduate students. Very few postgraduate students with disabilities come onto campus. And for this, we are starting off with a cohort of 5 disabled students in this upcoming semester that starts in September. Mm-hmm. And out of the 5 students, 2 are mobility impaired, 1 is deaf, and 2 are blind students. So it's not just the students that I have to actually, you know, assure that things will not change that much. This will be actually a positive experience. It's also the faculty members, because they have never really taught a class with all 3 different disabilities at one go. So it is a challenge, not just for students. It's also for faculty members. But I think this is an interesting challenge. And there's no point taking ginger steps, because at the end of the day, if you want to do it, you just do it.
I like that.
Dr. Derek, you were mentioning earlier about how important it is for persons with disabilities to be part of that conversation when it comes to public policy. Has it been that absent in the past?
Well, it has been absent. So the phrase that emerged out of the CRPD negotiations was "nothing about us without us." And what that sort of what that means is that persons with disabilities should be at the table when policy issues about them are being negotiated and discussed and debated. Not just because it's a nice thing to do,
right,
but because they have unique experience. Their lived experience and solutions for addressing problems comes out of their lived experience.
Can you give us examples, perhaps, of how things can go wrong?
Absolutely. Yeah. We had an example, a fantastic example on Tuesday at our multi-stakeholder roundtable that Dr. Islam and I helped to co-host. We had a colleague from Singapore who talked about the need to put in a stair lift just because they felt like that they needed to do that. And so they didn't consult with any mobility impaired students or faculty. So they put it in a place that nobody wanted to access, nobody needed to access. So they spent a fairly large amount of money.
$100,000, I remember.
Right. And nobody ever used it. So that's an example.
Right.
And so the need is to take the expertise and the experience of persons with disabilities, include them in the discussion, and you can have new insights that you hadn't yet considered. Mm. There was a really wonderful story of an architect that became blind, as Dr. Islin said, and used his newfound blindness to develop buildings in ways that sighted customers hadn't thought about before. Yeah. You know, new features and so forth that might maybe hadn't been considered before. So finding ways to include persons with disabilities in the conversation is absolutely critical.
And Dr. Islin, tell us a little bit more about the Master of Public Policy program at NPUMA, and you know, what can we look forward to, I mean, for those who are interested?
Well, if you're interested, it is a two-year program, a four-semester, two-year program. It is a face-to-face classroom environment. Most of our students, I would say it's about half and half. Half are actually working individuals and half are full-time students. And classes tend to be in the evenings because we cater for both sets of students. I would say even if you're working full-time, I've got a good number of students who can graduate on time within the two-year period, of course, working really hard. Mm-hmm. The study of public policy is multifaceted. So we cover not just economics, you have the option of doing science and technology, education policy, and that's why we feel that, you know, incorporating disability policy into the program itself is just one of the normal extension that can be easily adopted. With the aim that we'd like the graduates or what IDPP calls their fellows to come out upon graduation is to, as Derek mentioned, become an advocate for the issues themselves. Because what I notice, at least in our region, you know, there are cultural sensitivities when it comes to issues like this. It's viewed differently from our eyes. So, you know, you can have the UN convention that states this and that, but how we actually approach it from our point of view may differ. And it's really important, I think, for the disabled community themselves, coming from the cultural background that they are, to put forth their point of view in these issues. Because, you know, we may approach the same thing in a slightly different way.
Well, because those cultural sensitivities, I mean, they differ not just from postcode to postcode, but from state to state, from, you know, different sort of considerations. I mean, it's clearly challenging to bring them part of the conversation, but what has been the silver bullet that at least sort of normalizes the situation where that engagement can take place?
Well, I'm hesitant to refer to it as a silver bullet I'm always cautious, but I would say information and communication technologies can play a tremendously important role in that space, and I'll give you a couple of examples. So within ASEAN, you know that there's a very there's quite a bit of economic diversity, social and political, economic, religious diversity in ASEAN. So some countries are doing far better in terms of GNP and other indicators than others in the region. So if you start talking about these issues, let's say providing resources, academic resources to students who are blind and visually impaired, how do you do that? Well, traditionally, one might think, well, that needs to be in Braille. So in order for me to do that, I need to buy a Braille reader, which is several, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And, you know, I need to have, all these sort of equipment that I need to buy, right? Well, technology has come in with a way to address that in some ways. So all of the tools that we currently use to create content, electronic content like Microsoft Word, let's say, or PowerPoint, those can be used to build, to make accessible documents. It takes a little bit of training, but it's quite easy to make documents that are accessible. So what does that mean? It means when you create a document that a person who's blind, let's say, can access that document not using Braille, because that document is not Braille, but using something that's called a screen reader or text-to-speech, and there's a software package to do that. So some of the software packages are very expensive. So there's one called JAWS, which is Java Access with Speech. A licensed copy of JAWS costs about $1,400 to be able to pay for that. But it's extremely good. So a person who's completely blind can access websites, software, Word documents, PDF documents, PowerPoint documents, all on their computer, no Braille needed, you know, and so forth. So technologies continue to evolve, and so now there's an open source screen reading software called NVDA that was developed from Australia by two blind computer scientists. Wow. So they developed an open source screen reading software that's free. You download it and you can make it available to every person who's blind who can access that content. So the kind of cost that you might think about on the one hand in trying to provide accessible education now gets diminished tremendously by these technologies. So I would say perhaps technology.
And these technological innovations will be constantly evolving and changing, and they consistently have to configure into some of these policies that perhaps may be outdated in
Correct.
2 weeks or 2 months or 2 years.
Correct. Which helps to indicate why a program like Mpuma's, where you're training people to be critical thinkers, to be policy analysts, to be able to evolve with policy changes over time, because you're absolutely right, they're going to continue to change. I mean, some of the technologies are evolving so quickly. Both iOS and Windows mobile technologies are now, I mean, I could pull out my iPhone and turn on the automatic built-in screen reading features and show you how I can operate the whole phone with what's called a screen curtain on. I can turn the screen curtain on so the screen would be completely black, and I could show you how I could navigate through without Wow. looking at anything on the phone, and it comes built in.
I'm ashamed to say I knew nothing.
I only discovered Siri recently.
Well, folks, we've been speaking on a wide range of issues related to persons with disabilities and their role in public policy. If you miss any part of this program, you can download the podcast at www.bfm.my. In the studio with us, we've had Dr. Derek L. Cogburn, Executive Director of Institute on Disability and Public Policy, that's IDPP, as well as Dr. Islin Ismail, Deputy Director at the International Institute of Public Policy and Management in Puma at University of Malaya. This is the Evening Edition on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.